He gestures over at the puddle of water on the floor.
I want to get this cleaned up before the floor gets damaged, or more damaged.
He shakes his head.
Every time it rains, it starts leaking.
My eyes stray up to the dark spot on the ceiling where the drops of water are coalescing. But isn't there another level above this one? He gives me a lopsided grin.
Right. It's a mystery.
He carries the bucket over to the puddle on the floor, then he dips the mop in the water. The puddle shrinks. Do you own this place? I ask. He nods.
Me and my wife do, yes.
As he pushes the mop across the floor, I notice the glint of a wedding band on his left hand. I look down at my own left hand and see the simple gold band still in place. All of a sudden, it feels like it's burning my skin. I want to rip it off and throw it across the room.
I'm Nick, by the way,
he says. Hi, Nick, I say, but I don't offer my own name. He doesn't seem bothered by it. Nick gives the mop one last shove across the floor, then rests it against the wall. He places the bucket in the place where the water is dripping down. I suppose that's his makeshift solution. Once he's taken care of that, he goes behind the wooden counter. He leans his elbows on the counter as he looks at me.
So usually we charge $50 a night. Is that okay?
Is cash all right?
But of course.
He rifles below the counter.
Are you planning to stay just for the night or longer?
Just the one night. And maybe not even that long. Am I the only person staying here? He hesitates.
No, we have another guest, but she's more long-term.
He doesn't explain what that means, which is fine. I just want to feel like I'm not the only person in this semi-deserted motel. Yes, this guy seems harmless, but this is how scary campfire stories start. What about you and your wife? Do you stay here? Nick shakes his head.
Nah, we live in that old house right behind the motel, but I'll stick around for a while in case you need anything. I've got to fix that leak anyway.
He finally finds what he was looking for under the desk. It's a sheet of paper, old enough that it's turned stiff and yellow. It looks like some sort of information form for guests. He blows a layer of dust from the paper.
Would you fill this out for me?
Sure.
I pick up the ballpoint pen on the desk, but my hand feels frozen. I don't want to fill this out. I'll have to falsify every piece of information here, starting with my name. At some point, I'll have to shell out the money for a fake ID, but in the meantime, I should have a fake name to give people. Except, what? It should be something common that rolls off the tongue. Nothing memorable. Mary? Jennifer? Carol? My best friend in college was Kelly. That's innocuous enough. So I scribble down the name Kelly. And now I need to think of a last name.
I have to tell you, Nick says, this is the longest anyone has ever taken to write their name.
My cheeks burn. Oh,
listen.
He reaches for the yellowing piece of paper.
Don't worry about the form. You're just staying for the night.
He looks down at the one piece of information I gave him.
Okay, Kelly?
Okay, I say gratefully. I reach into my purse and extract $50 to pay him for the room. He takes the money and shoves it into the pocket of his jeans. Then he grabs a set of keys from under the counter.
I'll show you to your room,
he says. He glances at my luggage.
Let me get your bag for you.
I start to protest, but what the hell? I'm exhausted, and he looks strong. May as well let him carry my bag. I follow him up a set of stairs to the second floor. The stairs aren't lit at all, and with every step, they groan like the whole staircase is about to collapse at any second. I grab onto the banister for support, in case the stairs really do collapse, and it immediately shifts under my weight. This whole motel feels like it's about to fall apart any second now. Nick notices and flashes me an apologetic smile.
I need to tighten a few of the screws. Sorry about that.
No problem. The entire second floor seems to be lit by a single light bulb. There are three doors, two on the left and one on the right. Nick takes me past rooms 201 and 202, and then we stop at 203. He fishes the keys out of his pocket. As he's getting the door open, I notice the door to room 202 has cracked open. I turn around, and I feel, rather than see, somebody watching me from within the room. I tilt my head, trying to get a better look, but then the door slams closed. Is there somebody staying in room 202? I ask. Nick glances at 202, then back down at the keys.
Yeah, that's just Greta. She sort of lives here. She won't bother you.
I can't shake this uneasy feeling that I should leave this motel right now, grab my bag and get back on the road, no matter how hard it's raining or snowing. This place is trouble. But that's silly. It's warm and dry in here, and there's an actual bed that I can sleep in. Nick throws open the door to my room for the night. It's about what I expected. A small double bed with a stiff-looking bedspread and an old dresser with a small TV balanced on top, and a rickety wooden chair in the corner of the room. A crease forms between Nick's eyebrows as he watches my face.
Is it okay?
It's perfect, I say. He nods.
The TV has an antenna. It's not cable or anything. We might get a little reception, but I'm not sure if you will in the storm. And there's a phone, but it only calls the phones on the first floor. Most people have cell phones these days.
I think about the cell phone I tossed in the back of that pickup truck. I wish more than anything that I had a phone right now. But it's better that I got rid of it. I don't want anyone to track me here. Plus, if I could call Claudia, I'm not sure if I could resist the temptation.
And there's a private bathroom, he adds, a touch proudly. So you don't have to leave the room or anything. There's a shower and everything.
I shiver. I don't shower at motels. When I was a kid, I saw this movie where this woman got murdered while taking a shower at a motel. It scarred me for life. He smiles.
Well, it's there if you change your mind. I promise you won't be murdered.
To be honest, I'm tempted. My hair is damp and freezing. A hot shower seems like heaven right now. As I glance around the room, my stomach lets out a low growl. All I've eaten since lunch is those cheese doodles and a few Oreos while I was driving. And I have to say, I'm pretty burned out on cheese doodles and Oreos right now. Is there a way to get food? I ask. Nick chews his lower lip.
Sure. We don't have room service or anything, but I could throw something together for you in our kitchen. Like a turkey sandwich?
That sounds amazing, I breathe. He laughs.
Oh, it won't be. Believe me, my wife Rosalie, she was the cook.
I freeze for a moment. Did he just refer to his wife in the past tense? That's odd. And the name Rosalie sounds strangely familiar. Then it hits me where I heard the name before. The restaurant next to the motel. The one that's all boarded up, where I parked my car. It was called Rosalie's.
Anyways, he says, make yourself comfortable. I'll go make that turkey sandwich. If there's anything you need, just dial 0 on the telephone and it will ring downstairs. I'm going to be sticking around for a while fixing things.
Thanks, I say. He flashes me a disarming smile and my shoulders relax. My first impression was right. Nick is a nice guy. I'm safe here, at least for the night. But first thing in the morning, I've got to get the hell out of here. Chapter 8. After Nick leaves, I watch him walk down the hall, then back down those creaky stairs. When I swivel my head, the door to room 202 is cracked open again. And this time, there's a single eye staring out at me. I raise my hand in a tentative greeting, but before I can even get it in the air, the door swings shut again. Okay, then. I take a cue from my neighbor and shut my door behind me. I turn the lock, then notice the deadbolt on top. I hesitate for a moment, then throw that as well. Not that I think anybody is going to murder me in the shower, but better not to take chances. My shirt and pants stayed relatively dry under my coat, but my socks and sneakers are absolutely soaked. I kick off my sneakers, then peel my socks off my feet. Fortunately, there's a radiator in the room, next to the window, so I put my wet sneakers and socks on top of it. The view from the window overlooks a small two-story house a stone's throw away that looks as badly in need of repair as the motel itself. It's hard to see with the ice coming down, but light is on in one of the second-story windows. There's the outline of a woman sitting in the window. That must be Rosalie, Nick's wife. I awkwardly raise my hand to wave at her. She doesn't wave back. People don't seem terribly friendly here, and that's just fine. I step away from the window and open up my luggage. It takes me less than a minute to realize the horrible truth. I forgot to pack socks. I brought my jewelry, but I didn't bring socks. If Claudia were here, she would tease me mercilessly, and I would deserve it, because who goes on the run without bringing a few pairs of socks with them? God, I miss Claudia so much. It's a good thing the phone doesn't dial outside lines, because I would be painfully tempted to call her. And that would be a terrible idea, even though I'm desperate to hear her voice just one last time. If she were with me, I would have known to pack socks. If I had listened to her in the first place, I never would have married Derek. She warned me, repeatedly. She told me she didn't think he was a good guy. But he was just so perfect when he was courting me. There was no way to know what kind of monster he was. But up until today, I didn't quite know how awful he was. Some of our senior staff had to go to a conference this weekend, so they all took off early. The bank closed shortly after lunch, and we were given an unexpected half day. I was excited to have an afternoon off. I rarely had the house to myself, and I thought I could take a nice long shower, then watch television as loud as I wanted without Derek yelling at me to keep it down. But then, when I walked through the front door, Derek was already home. I was shocked to see him, and he seemed even more shocked to see me. The second I entered the living room, his face contorted in anger. "What are you doing here?" he demanded to know. "Nothing," I stammered. "I got out of work early, that's all." "Are you sure that's all you're here for, or are you meeting some guy?" I tried to explain about the conference, the unexpected half day. I plastered a smile on my face and tried to suggest we do something together, as a couple. Maybe go to the movies or go shopping, or up to the bedroom even. But Derek couldn't let it go. He kept insisting I came home to meet another man. And the jealousy was ironic, given I was certain he had cheated on me many times. He even kept an apartment in Boston, which he claimed was for business purposes, since his company is based in the city. But I'm pretty sure it was his little bachelor pad. I tried to talk him down, but it became obvious he was working himself into a rage. I had never seen him quite like this. But even when his hands balled into fists, I didn't really think he was going to hurt me until I felt his hands around my neck. And that was the last straw. He pushed me around long enough. I would not let him take my life. The part that I still don't understand is why he got so angry this time. For a moment, when I first came home, he had been smiling. I thought he was having a good day. I thought we might have a pleasant afternoon together. He seemed happy to see me, and then a second later, the smile dropped off his face. I don't understand why. Oh my God. It finally makes sense. Why he was smiling when he heard someone was at the door. Then he immediately got angry. He was happy because he didn't know it was me. He was expecting somebody else. Another woman. I sank down onto the bed, shivering from my cold feet. It makes total sense. Derek came home early to meet some other woman, and when he saw me, he was angry because I had ruined his tryst by showing up. Also, in his warped mind, he assumed anyone coming home early was there to fool around because that's what he was doing. I feel sick. This is not good news. I can only hope that in the last minutes of his life, Derek sent a text message to his girlfriend to tell her not to come, because if he didn't, the police may have already discovered his body. And if that's the case, it means they're already looking for me. And I have left them a wonderful trail of breadcrumbs. That gas station, the police officer who pulled me over for the broken taillight, for God's sake. And here I am, a sitting duck in a hotel only about 20 minutes from where I was last spotted. But then again, there's a blizzard evolving outside. That will make it hard for them to search for me, and moreover, the blizzard makes it impossible for me to leave. Not tonight, anyway. I grab the remote control from the end table and turn on the television. Immediately, snow fills the screen. That's right, this television has an antenna. I can't remember the last time I dealt with a television antenna. I have only vague memories of my parents fiddling with an antenna when I was barely out of diapers. I didn't know they even still made television antennas. But then again, this TV looks extremely old, like they bought it cheap at a pawn shop. Everything in this hotel looks like it was made several decades ago. I get up out of bed and wince as my bare feet touch the freezing wooden floor. I walk over to the television and attempt to adjust the antenna. After a minute, I get a clear picture. Although, if I let go of the antenna, it fades away. So I guess I'll have to stand here if I want to watch television. I don't want to watch television. I just want to see the news. There's a pretty blonde woman on the screen announcing the top stories for the night. Mostly, they're talking about the blizzard. I listen carefully, waiting to hear anything about the murder of a 34-year-old man named Derek Alexander. Nothing. Maybe I'm in the clear. At least for now. I shiver again. My feet feel like blocks of ice. How could I forget to bring socks? Who would be that stupid? Then again, it's not like I was thinking clearly. After a moment of consideration, I release the antenna and the picture on the television turns to snow again. But that's fine. I pick up the phone and dial 0. It rings about 5 times before I hear Nick's voice on the other line.
Kelly? Everything okay?
My first thought is, who is Kelly? But then I remember. I feel a little silly asking this. I'm just wondering, do you have any extra socks? He chuckles.
Well, no, not here. I could ask my wife if...
He pauses.
You know what? You should ask Greta. In room 202. She'll give you some socks.
Greta? Given that she slammed the door in my face when I was about to wave to her, I'm reluctant to knock on her door and attempt to ask her for socks. She doesn't seem very friendly.
No, she's just... She's nice. Really. She's an old woman. Harmless.
I don't know. My eyes dart over to the radiator, where my socks still look sopping wet. If anything, they look even more wet than when I put them there. I guess I could ask.
She'll be happy to give you some socks. She's a little eccentric, but she's just lonely. But I promise she's nice. She's lived here for years.
I'm not excited about this, but Nick doesn't seem like he's going to rustle up a pair of socks for me. So, if I want my feet to be warm and dry, this is my only option. Okay.
And I'll be up in a few minutes with the turkey sandwich. Sorry, I got a bit, delayed.
After we hang up the phone, I stare at the door to the room. Nick said the woman in 202 is a harmless old lady, but there was something about those eyes staring out at me from the crack in her door. It creeped me out. And if the police do eventually show up here looking for me, I don't need another witness they can talk to. Then again, my feet are freezing. To hell with it. I flip open the deadlock and unlock the door. Then I tromp across the hallway in my bare feet to room 202. I hesitate for half a second, then knock on the door. After a good 10 seconds, I hear a voice behind the door.
Who is it?
Hi. I chew on my thumbnail, a bad habit I had as a child that seems to have resurfaced. I'm staying in room 203, across the hall, and I was wondering if you could help me out with something. There's a long silence. For a moment, I wonder if she simply walked away, but then I hear the turning of locks, and a second later, the door cracks open. For the first time, I can see her clearly. She's older than I thought. Her hair is long and fine, and as white as the snow falling outside. Every millimeter of her face is lined with wrinkles. Her watery blue eyes stare up at me.
What do you need?
She says in a crackly voice. She sounds like she used to be a smoker, or maybe she still is, but I don't smell cigarette smoke coming from her room. I smile apologetically. Socks, actually. I forgot to pack them for my trip. Her eyes drop to my bare feet, then back up again to my face.
You want to borrow a pair of socks?
Yes. I squeeze my hands together. I'll rinse them out in the morning when my own socks are dry.
If you are going on a trip, it is important to pack socks.
Right, I know. I just forgot. She considers this for a moment. Finally, she backs away from the door and opens it enough to allow me inside. Room 202 looks a lot different from my room. It's about the same size, maybe slightly larger, but it looks lived in. Nick told me she has been staying in this room for years, and I believe it. Instead of the stiff bedspread in my own room, her blankets are made of wool and covered with exotic multicolored patterns. She has multiple lamps that give the room a yellow glow, and the wall is lined with mirrors so I can see myself no matter where I look. I don't look too good right now.
I am Greta, she says.
She has the very slightest hint of an accent that I can't identify. East European, I think. I'm Kelly, I say. She sniffs.
If you do not want to give me a real name, don't even bother.
I open my mouth to protest, but then shut it. She's right. That isn't my real name. As I wait for Greta to rifle around inside her dresser drawer, I look down at a deck of cards she has on her dresser. It takes me a second to realize that they're not playing cards, but rather tarot cards. Next to them is an orb that glows in the yellow light of the room. Greta sees me noticing them and comments,
I was a fortune teller at the carnival for 30 years.
I manage a smile. So you can read the future? She pauses for a moment and looks up at me. Her watery blue eyes rake over my bedraggled appearance.
For some, yes.
I don't really believe in any of that stuff, but I don't tell her that. It seems like she's getting a kick out of trying to freak me out. As long as I get my socks.
I have stockings.
She finally says, as she pulls a pair of crinkled tan stockings from the drawer.
Is it socks you require?
Well, I don't require them. I shift between my feet. But if you have them... Greta holds up a finger. She throws open the closet on the wall and pulls out a large black trunk that probably weighs more than she does. She fiddles with the lock to get it open. I feel guilty that she's going to so much trouble for a pair of socks. Have you lived here a long time? I ask politely.
Many years, she confirms. Since I retired.
She raises her eyes.
You are in room 203.
That's right, I say. And I guess 201 is empty then?
The lock on the trunk opens with a click. Nick always leaves 201 empty. I nod.
Because of the leaky pipe, right?
No, she says. Not because of that.
Then why?
Because.
Greta pulls a ball of socks out of the trunk and gets back on her feet while holding on to the wall for support.
Because a couple of years ago, a woman was murdered in there.
She says it so matter-of-factly, like this is something everyone must know. That somebody was killed there in the recent past. Yet again, I desperately wish I had my phone. I could find out in a second what went down at the Baxter Motel. I have a feeling Greta here knows all the details. What happened? I ask. Greta clutches the sock ball in her hand, studying my face with her shrewd eyes.
It was a pretty young woman like you. About your age. Also with the blonde hair. Her name was Christina Marsh. She came to stay here for a few days, but then I noticed she hadn't come out of her room in a while.
She looks over my shoulder at something in the distance.
It wasn't just that, though. Something was wrong. I knew it. So I told Nick to go check on her, and
I stare at her, not wanting to hear the rest of the story, but unable to keep from hearing it.
She was lying in her bed, stabbed to death, she says. Nick found her there. The police said she'd been dead for about a day.
I clasp my hand over my mouth. That's horrible. Did they ever find out who did it?
She shakes her head slowly. They never did, but they suspected Nick. There were no signs of forced entry, so it stood to reason whoever killed her had access to her room.
Oh. I remember my first impression of Nick and how I thought he was the sort of person who wouldn't hurt a fly. But impressions aren't always right. Do you think that he... Greta is silent for a moment. She stares up at me with those watery, red-veined eyes.
No, she says. Nick would never do something like that. The police had it wrong. I told them as much.
I let out a breath and my shoulders sag. I don't know what I would have done if Greta told me she thought Nick was a murderer. But of course she wouldn't think that. Why would she live here if she thought the owner was a killer?
But there was another reason they thought Nick killed her, she adds.
I raise my eyebrows. What reason? Her slightly yellow tongue protrudes from her mouth and she licks her lips.
I don't like to tell tales.
Really? Because it seems to me she likes to tell tales very much. But I can't say that. She holds the socks out to me and I take them. The material feels rough in my hands, like they haven't been worn in decades. But they will do. Thank you, I say. She nods.
Be careful.
I don't know what she means by that. She's not wrong. I am in danger. But she doesn't know why. As I turn, I come face to face with yet another mirror. Why does she have so many mirrors in her room? It's hard to look at myself right now. My blonde hair is limp and lifeless and so short now that I don't even recognize myself. My eyes look sunken in their sockets, and my cheeks are dark as well. If anything looks frightening in this place, it's me.
I love mirrors, Greta tells me. Mirrors are the barriers between the conscious and unconscious mind. Everyone has an inner concept of themselves, but mirrors are reality. What you see right now, that is the truth that everyone else sees.
Right, I mumble.
If you stay here, she says, I'll do a reading for you tomorrow. You may find it enlightening.
That's okay, I'm not staying.
The future may surprise you.
If I wasn't feeling so uneasy, I might have rolled my eyes. This woman can't see into the future. She doesn't even have socks in her drawer. She's obviously trying to scare me. I bet nobody even died in room 201. She probably made the whole thing up to freak me out. Well, it won't work. Thanks for the socks, I say. I'll leave them on your doorstep in the morning.
Keep them, she says. You should have an extra pair of socks.
It's a nice gesture, although the second I make it out of here, I'm going to buy some socks in a drugstore or something. And some hair dye. I slip out of her room, the socks clutched in my right hand. I can't see the future, but I predict I will never see this woman again. Chapter 9. The socks are horrific. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, considering what that woman's room looked like. They are just as stiff and uncomfortable as I thought they would be, but the worst part is the pattern on them. At first, I think it's just diamonds and ovals, but after a second, I realize what it actually is. Eyes. The pattern on the socks is eyes. Just as I get the eyeball socks on, I hear a knock at the door. I nearly fling it open, but then I remember Greta's story about the woman who was murdered in her room. Yes?
It's Nick. I've got a turkey sandwich for you.
Just as he says the words, my stomach lets out a growl. I had almost forgotten how hungry I was. I unlock the door, and Nick is standing there with a white plate in his hand. Thank you. I take the plate from him, and without even putting it down, I grab half of the sandwich and start stuffing it in my mouth. Mmm. He laughs at my eagerness.
Good?
Yeah, so good. Sorry I'm being rude.
Not at all.
He grins.
I'm just glad you like it. It's just, you know, whatever we had in the fridge.
I stuff another bite into my mouth. What do I owe you? He shakes his head.
Don't worry about it. Meals are included.
Oh, okay. I feel a little bad about it, considering he doesn't have many guests, and it looks like this place is falling apart, so I'm thinking he's not rolling in it. But then again, I'm not in any position to be throwing around money. Thank you again. He glances down at my feet.
I see you got your socks. Greta gave them to you?
Yes, she did. She's, very interesting. Nick throws back his head and laughs.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? Did she offer to tell your fortune?
Despite myself, I laugh too. Yes, she did.
That's her thing. She was some sort of carnival psychic. It's all a good show.
I pause before taking another bite of my turkey sandwich. Did she ever tell your fortune?
He snorts. Yeah, she told me the usual thing. You're going to die young, horrible misfortune. Like I said, it's a good show. It's what she does. I wish she could have told me about that pipe breaking. Now that would have been useful.
I swallow a chunk of turkey and bread. Did a woman really die in room 201? The smile vanishes from Nick's face. Whatever else, it's obvious this particular piece of information is absolutely true.
She told you that?
I nod. He rubs at the back of his neck.
What did she say?
I study his face, his light brown eyes, the stubble on his chin. She said it was a young woman and she was stabbed to death in the room. And you found her. He coughs.
Yeah, all of that is true.
A chill goes down my spine and then all the way to my toes, even though I'm wearing socks now. That must have been awful.
Yeah.
His eyes drop.
It was. I've never seen anything like that before. I never want to see it again. I still sometimes have nightmares.
That's horrible, I murmur. And they never found out who killed her? He lifts his eyes, but he's not looking at me. He's looking at the window behind me.
No, they never did.
Oh, I murmur.
Anyway,
his smile seems forced.
If there isn't anything else you need, I'm going to head back over to my house. Rosalie, she doesn't like to be alone when there's a storm. I can fix the pipe in the morning.
Of course. I think of the silhouette in the window of the house across the way. The woman who didn't wave back. Will your wife be over here in the morning? Nick shakes his head.
No. She doesn't come to the motel anymore. She's been ill. I've been taking care of her.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. That must be hard. He lifts a shoulder.
She's my wife. In sickness and in health, right?
He looks pointedly at the wedding band on my left hand.
You know what I'm talking about.
I suck in a breath. I can't tell him I just stuck a knife in the man who gave me this ring. Yes, of course.
Good night, Kelly. I'll see you in the morning.
I clutch the plate with my half-finished turkey sandwich while I watch Nick walk down the hall. He seemed like he was in such a good mood until I brought up the murder in 201. He's obviously still very affected by it. There's another reason they thought Nick killed her. Everything Greta told me in that room was true. I wonder what she was talking about that time. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I won't be in this motel for much longer. First thing in the morning, I'm back on the road. As soon as the snow stops. I flip around the Do Not Disturb sign on my door, then I close the door and lock it. I walk over to the window, watching the flakes fall from the sky. I wish I could check the weather app on my phone to see how long this is going on for. I should have checked it out before I ditched my phone. I've got a shovel in the back of my car, though. I'm getting out of here one way or another. I look across the way at the small house right next door. It's run down, but there's something majestic about the large, swooping windows, the brick chimney, and the cone jutting from the top floor, almost like it's a castle. With some work, it could be really beautiful. It's a fixer-upper, that's for sure. Nick said his wife was sick. I wonder if they had plans to fix it all up, but then got derailed. I know what it's like to have plans get derailed. That light is still on in the upstairs window. The silhouette of Rosalie Baxter stares right back at me. I don't lift my hand this time. In fact, I let the curtains fall closed with only a small crack between them. That's when I see movement behind Rosalie's silhouette. It must be Nick having come home. I peer through the tiny crack in the curtains, watching them. He bends down next to her, talking to her. He reaches out and touches her face. I expect him to lean in to kiss her, but he doesn't. I watch as he stands up. Suddenly, he's pacing the room. He seems upset, but of course I can't hear a word of the conversation. And then he stops pacing. He lifts his head and looks straight through the window. I jerk my head away from the window. He couldn't possibly see me, could he? No, it's impossible. But either way, I shouldn't be snooping. Whatever he's doing with his wife in his own home is private. It's none of my business. I turn back to the television. I'm dying to know if there's anything on the news about Derek. There's no way for me to leave this motel tonight, but if they haven't discovered the body yet, I have a bit of breathing room. I really wish I had my phone with me to browse the web, but that would have made me a sitting duck. I turn on the television, but the entire screen is just a mass of snow. I fiddle with the antenna, turning it every which way, making it longer, then shorter. It's hopeless. There's no reception. It's probably because of the storm. Well, maybe if the storm is this bad, it means they're not out there looking for me. I wince at the thought of Scott Dwyer discovering my husband's dead body. I still don't quite understand why he didn't insist on coming into the house to check things out. Isn't that protocol? If you hear screams, don't you have to look inside? But he's going to find the body eventually. I wish it could be somebody else who makes the discovery.
I don't want Scott to know what a mess my life has become in the last decade. A sob rises at the bottom of my throat when I think back to the simpler days in high school, when I first got to know Scott. Of course, my life was far from perfect then. The pain of both my parents being suddenly killed was still raw. Most days, I went straight home after school and studied. Before my parents died, I used to get involved in extracurricular activities, but I couldn't bring myself to do it anymore, especially since they had been going to see one of my plays when the accident happened. For most of high school, I kept to myself. I kept my nose in a book, and most of the other kids saw me as aloof or even stuck up. Anyway, they left me alone. But Scott made an effort. He would talk to me in class, and he started walking me to my next class afterwards. He would joke around until I would smile, which was no small feat because I did not smile easily. Then one day, while we were talking about how unseasonably hot it was outside, I noticed his shoulder brushing against mine as we walked. He noticed it too, and he grinned in my direction. Whenever he looked at me, it was with this expression of unbridled affection, like he thought I was the coolest, most wonderful girl he'd ever met. And then when we got to my social studies class, he had a class at the exact same time at the entire other end of the school and was undoubtedly late for it every single day because of me. He rubbed a hand through his hair, enough to make it stick up straight in the air. His smile was adorably nervous. "It's so hot outside. Maybe we could go to Frosty's for some ice cream after class is over?" It took me a split second to realize what was happening. Scott was asking me out on a date. And I realized how much I wanted it. "That sounds nice." I didn't appreciate him. I was too young, and I didn't know what other boys were like. I thought every boy would race around the side of his broken-down Ford to keep me from opening the door on my own, would drive me home every single day after school, even if it meant he had to rush back to school to get to swim team practice, would kiss me softly and sweetly and respectfully and ask permission before he tried anything we hadn't done before. Unlike Derek, who always had some idea of perfection I could never achieve, Scott seemed thrilled just to be with me. He was sweet, yes, but also a bit boring, a bit too nice, and I was going to college while he was sticking around our hometown, working at his dad's store. It seemed very much like a high school kind of relationship, and I never really thought we would stay together when I went to college. And we didn't. Then when I moved back to the town after college, I ran into him at the grocery store and found out he had become a police officer. And also that he had filled out quite nicely. And the way he was looking at me, I could tell he still felt the same way about me that he did in high school. "Maybe we could get a drink later," he suggested. But I had just started my job at the bank, and I was so busy trying to make a good impression. So I put him off, thinking we would do it another time. And then that other time never came. And then, of course, Derek entered my life. I imagine Scott walking into the kitchen at my old house, the one I'll probably never see again. I imagine him looking down at Derek's dead body, his eyes filling with disgust. The next time I see Scott, he won't give me that familiar look of affection. He'll never look at me that way again. God, I have made such a mess of everything. I push thoughts of Scott Dwyer out of my head. Right now, I need to sleep. I've got a long day of driving ahead of me, and since there's nothing else I can do right now, I should do my best to rest up. But I have a bad feeling sleep will be difficult. Chapter 10.
I got the worst night's sleep of my life. I didn't lie awake. That would have been preferable to what happened, which is that I dozed off and woke up every hour on the hour with horrible nightmares. But they weren't exactly nightmares. They were memories. We had our first date at a French restaurant. It was so much fancier than what I was used to. We didn't have a lot of money growing up, and of course, things got much harder after our parents died and it was just me and Claudia. I wasn't used to being spoiled that way. I opened up the menu and was immediately intimidated. It was entirely in French, and I had a feeling that even if I spoke French, I wouldn't have known what half these dishes were. I timidly asked Derek what was good, and he told me he would order for both of us. He didn't even ask me what sort of things I liked to eat. But his confidence was compelling. It was so different from every other man I'd ever dated. Derek ordered some special fancy red wine. He actually sniffed the cork. The server poured it into my glass, and Derek watched eagerly as I took a sip. "What do you think, Quinn?" I sat there, unsure how to distinguish this fancy wine from the kind I got for $10 from the local liquor store. "It's got a fruity note," I finally said. It didn't. It tasted exactly like the $10 wine. Derek beamed at me, and I felt like I had gotten the right answer on a test. He was so handsome and dripping with charm and charisma. He seemed better than me. Claudia would have been angry if I said that, but I couldn't help feeling that way. He ordered us something called coq au vin, which he explained was hen-braised in red wine. I also tried foie gras, which is apparently duck liver. It tasted terrible to me, but over the last several years, I grew to appreciate the taste. And then, as we were finishing up the most divine chocolate souffle, Derek leaned in and kissed me. In real life, it was a lovely kiss that led to a second date, then a third, then far too soon, a proposal I couldn't say no to. But in my dream, we had that same dinner, the same expensive wine, and the same delicious chocolate souffle, and he kissed me the same way. But when he pulled away, there was a red stain spreading across his white dress shirt. "Quinn," he gasped. I looked down and saw a steak knife in my right hand. It was covered in my husband's blood. I let it clatter to the floor, but it was too late. "You bitch," Derek managed as the color drained from his face. "Call an ambulance." But I didn't call an ambulance. I just stood there, watching the life drain out of him. I let my husband die on the floor of my kitchen. So that's my other secret. I stabbed Derek in the abdomen to keep him from strangling me. But there was a moment when I might have been able to save him. If I had run straight to the phone and dialed 911, maybe he would be alive right now. But I didn't. Yes, I killed him in self-defense, but I wanted him to die. Not only that, but I waited to make sure he was dead. I stood there, watching him bleed out. As he cried for help, he begged me to call an ambulance until he lost consciousness. And even after he was unconscious, I still waited. Waited until his chest stopped rising and falling. Waited until I couldn't feel a pulse in his wrist. I wake up with a start in my uncomfortable double bed in the hotel room. For a moment, I'm completely disoriented. I have no idea where I am. But then it all comes rushing back to me. Where I am, what I've done. I sit up in bed, my heart pounding. I've got to get out of here. I look at my wristwatch. It's close to 9:00. I don't know how I managed to sleep so late when I was hardly sleeping at all, but I can't even waste a second getting back on the road. I don't have time to attempt to get the television to work to check out the news. I'll listen to it on the car radio. I hit the bathroom to empty my bladder and splash some water on my face. When I look at my reflection in the mirror, I flinch. I look awful. My blonde hair is at least dry by now, but it looks like it was cut with, well, a pair of scissors in somebody's bathroom. The strands are limp and lifeless, and there are dark purple circles under my eyes. I look like I've aged 10 years overnight. But the worst part is I still look like me. Yes, a bedraggled version of me, but I'm still clearly Quinn Alexander. If anybody saw a photograph of me, I'm recognizable, even with my hair hacked off. I don't know what to do to change my appearance. In the short term, I need to buy some hair dye, something dark but not a black color that will draw attention. And I can try to pack on some weight, although I can't imagine how I'll accomplish that when I have no money for food. Anyway, I'll figure it out later. Right now, I've got to get out of here. As I pull on my blue jeans, I hear a rap at the door. My heart thuds in my chest. Is it the police? Have they come looking for me? But then I hear Nick's voice.
Kelly?
Hang on. I grab my socks off the radiator. They're very stiff, but warm and dry. I stuff my feet into them and run a hand through my hacked off hair. Coming! I crack open the door and Nick is standing there holding a plate of food. It appears to be scrambled eggs and a few slices of crisp bacon. My stomach growls at the sight of it.
Sorry to disturb you.
He looks pointedly at the sign hung from my doorknob.
But I made you some breakfast. I figured you'd be hungry.
He's right. At the sight of the plate of food, my stomach groans painfully. The eggs are brown, but I couldn't care less. I could devour them in one bite. Thanks. I'm going to get on the road pretty soon, though. Nick's eyebrows shoot up to his hairline.
On the road?
Yeah. I glance out the window. The snow stopped, right?
Right, but...
He frowns.
We're buried. I can't get a plow to come out here till the late afternoon. I don't see where you parked, but unless you've got a huge truck, I don't see how you're getting out of here.
My stomach sinks. Are you serious? He shifts between his feet.
I'm sorry. I can try calling the plow company again, but we got about 2 feet of snow here last night.
No, no, no. This can't be happening. I've got to get out of here. Maybe I could dig out my car. I grip the white plate in my hands, my appetite suddenly gone. Would you help me?
Help you?
Help dig me out. I'm gripping the plate so hard it feels like it might shatter in my hands. I've got to get out of here today, please. Nick glances over my shoulder, out the window at the blinding white snow coating absolutely everything.
I guess we can try, but there's a lot of snow out there. Where did you park, anyway? You're not in the lot right outside.
I parked by that diner, the one that's boarded up.
Okay.
He lifts his shoulders.
We can give it a shot.
He looks down at my feet.
You got boots?
Of course I don't have boots. I don't even have freaking socks. No, it's fine, though. He rubs the stubble on his jaw.
Let me borrow a pair from Rosalie. You look like you're about the same size.
Something about borrowing a pair of boots from his sick wife makes me feel a little uneasy. It's fine.
It's not fine. There's a lot of snow out there. You're going to lose a toe if you don't have a pair of decent boots on.
He makes a good point. If you're sure it's okay, he nods at the plate of food.
Why don't you eat breakfast, then I'll meet you downstairs with the boots.
I agree to it. But his expression doesn't make me feel hopeful. What if I can't get out of here? I'm a sitting duck right now. After he's gone, I shovel eggs into my mouth while I attempt to get reception on the television. The eggs are pretty terrible. They are dry and bland, and the bacon is burned. He did better with the turkey sandwich. To be fair, it's hard to ruin a turkey sandwich. I tune into the local news, but there's no mention of any sort of murder. Again, most of the news is about the blizzard. I don't know if it's just that the story hasn't hit the news yet, or if nobody has discovered Derek's body yet. It seems almost impossible they haven't discovered him yet, that he's just lying on the kitchen floor, dead, and nobody knows it. How long does it take for a body to decompose? It couldn't already be happening, could it? Not in the cold, at least. It's almost impossible to think of Derek that way. He was so strong and big and full of life. He was larger than life. For him to be dead. He is dead, isn't he? Isn't he? The thought hadn't occurred to me. I stood there and waited to make sure he was gone. He bled out all over the kitchen floor. He's definitely dead. He wasn't breathing. He's dead. But it's not like I'm a doctor. It seemed like he wasn't breathing. I couldn't feel a pulse. He was so still, and there was so much blood. There's no way he could still be alive. Before I left the house, I didn't check him. I couldn't bear to. I just assumed he was still lying on the kitchen floor the way I left him. It's like that feeling you get when you left your house in the morning and you're not sure if you shut off the lights or locked the door. Except a million times worse. What if the reason nobody's looking for me is that Derek isn't actually dead? I feel like I'm going to throw up the eggs I just ate. A few moments ago, I felt confident of one thing. Derek was dead. I was sure of it. But now I'm not so sure anymore. What if he got up off the floor, got himself patched up, and now he's out there looking for me? Either way, I need to get the hell out of here. I look down at my left hand, where my wedding band is still there, taunting me. Whatever else, I want that stupid thing off my hand. I yank it off roughly. My skin is a couple of shades whiter where the band used to be. The first thing I'm going to do is get rid of that tan line. I pull open the dresser drawer next to the bed. The only thing inside is a copy of the Bible. I shove my ring in the drawer and slam it shut. I grab the key to the room and lock it behind me when I leave. I consider bringing my bag with me, but I decide to leave it behind. I can swing by the motel entrance and toss it in on my way out.
Leaving so soon?
I whirl around, Greta standing behind me. She's wearing a long, light blue nightgown that grazes her ankles. Unlike me, she doesn't seem at all bothered by being in her bare feet. Yeah, I say. Got to get going.
There's a great deal of snow out there.
Right, I say irritably. Nick is going to help me dig my car out. Greta looks down at my feet. All I've got on now are my socks.
Interesting choice of footwear.
I grit my teeth. Nick told me he would borrow a pair of boots from his wife.